And now I would now like to introduce Monty. Please come down, Monty. Thank you.
So my name is Monty. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the new people. I know the Court Slip people don't particularly want to get talked at, but I like to say you're either here to get out of trouble or you're here to get sober. And if you're lucky, you'll do both. So please try to take advantage of what we offer here. Like I said, and happy birthday to all the people, and particularly the sons that have their moms come and watch them help recover or help celebrate. My life is a celebration of recovery, and my recovery is a celebration of life. That's, you know, my higher power is life. It is love. It is the universal whatever it is that motivates, you know, everything going on here. And I did not have that when I got here. You guys helped me develop that. I sit up here so grateful that my friend showed up, that you folks have asked me to speak. You know, the guy with 1 year says, let me help as many people as possible. And the guy with 5 years says, well, let me help just one person. And the guy with 10 years says, well, just don't let me chase anybody away. So my sobriety date is Thanksgiving 1981. So I've been blessed. And the things I want to talk about is I should have drank myself out of the Navy. But luckily in 1981, the Navy did have a program. My last drunk is the summer of 1981. I had always been on a submarine where I stood duty every 3 days and I didn't drink when I went to sea. And they made the mistake of putting me in school in Memphis, Tennessee for 90 days with no duty. And so I never sobered up. And about most of the way through that 90 days, they weren't sure they wanted me to teach school. I was an E5 looking at E4 that had taken the E6 exam. And so they had my attention and they said, we don't know what's wrong with you. Are you willing to be screened for substance abuse? And what they didn't know is that the wheels had come off for me. I had been crying in my pickup truck in Memphis, Tennessee, because my life didn't make sense anymore. I had gone from alcohol being my best friend, from alcohol being my solution, to alcohol making me feel sexy, cool, and tough, to alcohol not thinking I was sexy, cool, and tough enough, and then finally not caring whether I was sexy, cool, or tough. And I ended up the loneliest guy in a crowded bar. And so when they said, are you willing to be screened for substance abuse, I had a couple things that helped me, right? Most of us have a list of things, right? Not just one thing. I have a big list. And one of the things was I had an angel. And my angel was a loser that was like 3 years older than me in school. And I watched this guy, and he never fit in. And he was always doing weird things. And when we were both old enough to drink together, he was always too drunk, and he's always following people around. And I'm like, man, if I ever end up like that guy, you know, I'm a party animal. I'm not a pathetic alcoholic. But if I ever end up like that guy, you know, that's a problem. And so when I ended up like that guy in Memphis, Tennessee, in the fall of 1981, the Navy put me in treatment. I did not get why we worked the steps. I drank every day, but I drank particularly heavy on Friday and Saturdays to take the edge off, and I didn't know what to do to take the edge off. I know now we work the steps to take the edge off. You know that to be dry without a program of recovery is to be a dry drunk, and that's not a good thing. It's not recommended. The book calls it restless, irritable, and discontent, but I didn't want this to be my solution, and then the van might not have been welcome at the best meetings in town. But it seemed like AA was full of gray hair and cigarette smoke, and I didn't see the attraction. And so when I got out of treatment, I just didn't drink. Because of all the things you can hear in treatment, I heard out of chapter 3 that a real alcoholic can't go a year without drinking. Ha! Okay? Because I had never tried to stop drinking before. So, you know, I knew I shouldn't drink anymore, but I really Surrender, I was a Harley riding submarine sailor, and surrender was not part of my vocabulary. And the idea that I shouldn't drink anymore was pretty obvious, but that I needed you guys, I wasn't sure. In fact, I was really hoping that wasn't true, okay? And so I go a year, because I'm not just sick, I'm stubborn too. So I go a year without drinking, and the big book calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't know that was what it was called. I had a knot in my gut that when I was on leave, when I had money in the bank, when I wasn't fighting with the old lady, I had this knot in my gut. And since I hadn't had a drink in so long, I decided alcohol was not my problem. So I was a high anxiety person, and I would get some therapy for this anxiety, and I'd be okay. And the therapist I went to heard my story. He says, well, I won't work with an alcoholic that doesn't have a maintenance program, and I suggest you go back to AA. So I came back to prove him wrong. I'm sitting there taking everybody's inventory, noting all the differences between you and me, so I can tell this guy it ain't here for me, okay, because I've been there, and taking everybody's inventory, noting all the differences, and this little woman got up at the old El Cajon Alano Club, the one that burned down, and I think it was Little Patty, if you remember Little Patty, and she called it Alcohol Anonymous. So Zoom, my inventory taken mine, you know, aimed in on her, and she said she was alcoholic and her obsession to drink had been removed. And if I had heard that before, it had not registered. And I was thinking she's lying, right? She's either lying about being alcoholic or she's lying about the obsession being removed. But it got my attention, and I met my Eskimo. My Eskimo sent me to a men's meeting where I met other guys that rode motorcycles sober, sent me to a step study workshop. Remember, I had that knot in my gut, right? I had a physical symptom of being a dry drunk, basically. And in that, I went to that step study workshop, and they were on step three. So I said, what do I do? They said, catch up. So I'm sitting in my apartment in La Mesa, over there by Amaya and Severin, and for some reason, right, some reason, get it? I don't know why, I'm reading page 55 in the chapter to the agnostic, and that's the page where it says deep down within us. And for some reason, I'm just reading that page over and over, and it occurs to me that knot in my gut might be a way for me to get in touch with a power greater than myself. And I had one of those experiences of the weight of the world coming off my shoulders that, you know, so I say that was my first spiritual awakening. I'm just so blessed. If you knew Bobby Lewis and Maynard S. back in the day, they were El Cajon characters. And they always had pretty women on their arms. And they would tell them right out of the book, honey, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to, and you don't ever have to be alone again if you don't want to. Let's go. Okay? So I don't recommend that as for picking up women, but the message is still true. Nobody in this room ever has to drink again if they don't want to. Nobody in this room ever has to be alone again. And, you know, alcoholism for not drinking is a disease of loneliness. It's a disease of separation. It's a disease of being different, of not being understood. And I went to my noon meeting, and out of the mouths of babes and fools, this new guy got up. He had earrings all the way around his ear. So I noted him. And he gets up and he says, all my life I thought I was from a different planet. And then he says, I come to my first AA meeting and I found the other people from my planet. So there, you know, one of my nicknames for this fellowship is Misfits Anonymous, because I was always joining stuff and never felt like I fit in. And there was a time when I didn't think I'd fit in here either. And what that did is it got my attention that I had to be the friend I wanted you folks to be. I had to reach out my hand. I had to represent, right? And so I love what this house does, taking guys from like right out of detox and getting them jobs and getting them sober and getting them a little bit of self-discipline, right? Desiderata says, beyond a healthy self-discipline, be gentle with yourself, right? That's what I would tell everybody in here after 40 years. that we were so hard on ourselves. And being hard on yourself is good when you're new, but when you're still doing it 20 years and you're at war with yourself, that's no bueno. Because I talk a lot about emotional sobriety, because Bill wrote a really cool letter about emotional sobriety, and so I talk about that. There's therapists in AA and there's doctors, psychiatrists in AA, and they're not talking about emotional sobriety. So I asked the therapist about it. She had nothing to say. That was interesting. And then I asked a buddy who's long-term sober psychiatrist. I said, how come, nobody's talking about emotional sobriety? Clancy used to call them, Frank Hutter used to call old-timers with their heads in the oven, okay? And there are people like that. And in fact, they were attracted to my first sponsor, Bones. I always thought I'd be cool like Bones, and instead I ended up like one of those honorary old-timers because he was so welcoming, he was so accepting. And John knew who he was. But this emotional sobriety, I asked the psychiatrist about it. He says, well, it's a heuristic endeavor. I'm like, okay. You know, the guy's a Naval Academy, former naval officer, right? Heuristic, right? So I don't even know how to spell heuristic. So I have to look it up, right? It's H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C, heuristic. And what does it mean? The first definition is it's something you work out for yourself. You know, that the individual works out for themselves. The second definition is trial and error. So, you know, what it looked like to me was we agree on how to get sober, but we don't agree on how to stay sober, okay? And when I talk about emotional sobriety, I like to bring up page 133. And in case you're not familiar with it, 133 is where it says, we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. It's also on the same page further down that God has provided us with many good psychiatrists and psychologists. And what I say is, if you're here and if you're doing everything we say to do and you're not happy, joyous, and free, you might ask for outside help. So I do a thing with emotional sobriety called Sobriety 911. And rule number one is always a deeper surrender. Rule number two is get a bigger God. Rule number three is ask for help without knowing where it's going to come from or what it's going to look like. Number four is this figures. Doesn't it? To be as willing to change as I was when I was a newcomer. Because when I get some time in this program, I get rigid, okay? And the joke is that I get the right kind of resentments because now God and me are both pissed, okay? But it's still a resentment. It'll still take me out. It still removes me from the sunlight of the Spirit. And it can take me out of meetings and eventually take me out of this fellowship, even with time. And then the last one, which is the hardest one, is to turn a humiliating experience into a humbling experience. So when I did that step study workshop, I was, I was going to tell you about my Eskimo, right? The guy that sent me to those meetings. And an Eskimo, there's two guys up in Alaska, and they're at one of those little combination restaurant slant bars, and they're having breakfast, and they hit it off. So the one guy asked the other guy to slide over two stools and get a drink with him. He says, oh, I don't drink. He says, why not? I said, well, I got a relationship with a power greater than myself, and I don't drink. He says, oh, you mean God. And the guy's like, well, yeah, but why do you say it like that? He says, oh, I gave your God a chance. He says, I was up there, up north of the Arctic Circle, and I didn't know if I was going to freeze to death first or if I was going to starve to death. I couldn't get warm, and I didn't have anything to eat. He says, I gave your God a chance. He didn't show up. The guy's like, you must believe you're here. He says, no, a goddamn Eskimo came along and showed me the way out. So I want you to look around. I want you to look around at the goddamn Eskimos in this room. I am just so grateful. So I wanted to share that story. I was 5 years sober. I was riding a brand new Harley Davidson called the Softail. It was a big deal because you couldn't see the shocks on it because they were hidden underneath the frame. and it was still had a chain drive, still had a four-speed transmission, had a Kickstarter that would not spin the bike quick enough for the electronic ignition to pick up, so it was useless. But it looked cool. It looked really cool. And I'm riding that bike, and I'm coming out of El Cajon going towards La Mesa. And I had been reading Chuck C's story, The New Pair of Glasses. And in the back of that book, he gives his version of the prodigal son. And I think most of us, including me, have lived that story in the Bible, right? It says he wasted his substance on riotous living, okay? And then he decides that the hired help at his house eats better than he does. So he's not going to go back and be the guy's son. He's just going to ask for a job. And when he gets there, the guy celebrates. My son has returned. So I've lived that life. I've lived that story. But here we go again. The motorcycle. Out of El Cajon, thinking about Chuck C's prodigal son. So, and this little voice is, this sarcastic voice that had been putting me down and putting my sobriety down for 5 years, says, ain't that a effing wonderful story? And this other little voice that I probably hadn't heard very much before said, why do you say that? And this old voice that had been putting me down and putting my sobriety down for 5 years says, because you didn't ask to be alcoholic. See, and it was like that voice had been nagging me for 5 years just to say that we had a resentment, that we had ended up alcoholic, and we didn't think we deserved it. We didn't think it was fair. I had worked the steps, right? I knew I had a resentment against my church, my family, and my school because they either didn't know what would make me happy or they weren't telling me. So either way, screw them off, I went. So that little voice had followed me around, you know, picking at my sobriety for 5 years just to say you didn't ask to be alcoholic. And then I, about 7 years sober, I go into therapy for codependency, but it's run by a recovering alcoholic lady, and she knows that drunks as a class of people are generally not codependent, they're counterdependent, that screw you, I don't need anybody, that, you know, let's just throw a match on it and run. That's not codependent, okay? But they talked about codependence and the people they were attracted to, and guess what? Needy, clingy, I'll die without yous. Love, screw you, I don't need anybody's, okay? So we dance really well together. And the reason I tell this story is I inventoried my adult romantic relationships. And there was times when I was settling, there was times when I was rescuing, and then there was what I called crazy. Okay, because it didn't make sense. And these women, I was totally in love with them, and they would tear my heart out and hand it to me. And it was like, how can love be so cruel? And so I'm reading about these codependent people and these counterdependent people, and codependency is based on neglect and abandonment, stuff you didn't get that you should have gotten. And the counterdependency, that screw you, I don't need anybody, is based on abuse. Based on the stuff that happened that shouldn't happen to anybody. And then the critical sentence in the book that I was reading, it's called Facing Love Addiction by Pia Melody. It says, and you, depending on the person and the situation, you can switch back and forth. See, because I don't know how cool I am or how much I've really, you know, achieved that, you know. Now I'm old and I don't care. But, you know, the thing was, I was normally a little bit aloof, right? And in some of these places, I had something to teach these women. So, and that romance works that way sometimes. But because when I decided they were the one, I switched over to be needy, clingy, why don't you want to be with me? And they were not interested in that wimp. They, you know, they were attracted to the other guy. And they were like, who is this guy? I'm going to get out of here as soon as I can. And funny thing is now, my wife and I were 25 years together, 24 years married. She's 34, 35 years sober. So we're both kind of counterdependent. We're both kind of, this is too hard, I'm out of here. And we know it. And so we don't scare each other with it. So that's part of my emotional sobriety. I do a thing about boy meets girl on AA campus. comes right out of the 12 and 12, right? It says we hope for a partner that we can have the complete relationship with, physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, right? And then two pages later, he says you need to make sure you're compatible emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. He leaves out physical, okay? And that, I tell people, don't sleep with anybody you're not best friends with, and then go really slow because you might be losing a best friend, okay? But we looked at what kind of stuff makes relationships work. This one book was really good. It said common interests, common values, common goals, right? And other sober people are really cool because if they're working on their own recovery, you can have hard conversations with them. That's, for me, the secret to relationships is hard conversations. Like, I'm not sure, you know, where this is going to go or what you're thinking, but, and that's part of what Dr. Paul, the acceptance guy, he says with his relationship with Max, he says, we can argue about what we think, but we can't argue about what we feel. And that goes back to that emotional sobriety that, you know, the kiss of death is I've been sober too long to feel this way, okay? And some old-timers end up that way. I had a friend, he's a Vietnam vet. He died of Agent Orange cancer during COVID. But he says after 20, 30 years, you got a better chance of taking your own life than you do of drinking because you know drinking ain't going to solve it and you still want out, okay? So I hope none of you guys ever get there, but I hope you know to be honest. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be honest. Let someone know what is going on with you. It turns out my depression was a belief system that I was crap and my life was crap and it was always going to be that way. And that was designed to buffer me or save me from future disappointment. When you always think crap's going to happen, you don't get hurt. But what I had to do, because I win some and I lose some, that's a spiritual rule like the axioms in the 12 and 12, I win some and I lose some, I have to look for the good stuff. I had to train my brain to look for the good stuff. And then I had to feel safe enough to feel the feelings that I had been avoiding. Because I have a therapist, she says that what we think are negative feelings are always messengers. They're letting us know that we're thinking something that isn't true. She calls those false beliefs, right? And so if I'm not feeling good, it's generally I'm believing something that isn't true. So, you know, I was raised with the John Wayne school of feelings, okay? That life's a party and someone pisses you off and you break their face and you go back to partying. And I wasn't big enough to make that work. In the household I was in, it was only the biggest person in the situation is allowed to be angry, okay? So I grew up waiting for when it was my turn to be the angry person because it wasn't safe for the rest of us. But that, now I work with guys that have anger problems and I say, let's admit right now that you're not an angry person, you're a sensitive person. And they're like, what? What? You know, this isn't pussy wimpy stuff. You know, I'm angry, I'm going to kill somebody. And I did my first fifth step because I had problems with sex and with God. I had did my first fifth step with an ex-priest that was homosexual because I figured there isn't anything I can't tell this guy. And when we get done, he says, I've forgiven you and God has forgiven you and now you need to forgive you. But the reason I bring that up, and you're going to have to help me again, because I was telling a story that was going towards a point. Oh, so my ex-wife, her cousin hitchhikes into town. The guy's 6'6", 300 pounds. He's penniless, right? And he's so happy to come visit us. And I am not happy to have him there. And I actually find out he's in town before she does. So I'm trying to figure out how to take the guy out. But I don't know what to do with a guy that's 6'6", 300 pounds. And so I'm calling people. And so I don't get him out. I don't get to take him out before he gets home. And now she knows he's there. So she's just so happy that he's in my living room. And I'm so angry I can't see straight. And I called my sponsor, and he didn't really help me. So I called that guy that I did my fifth step with. And he says, Monty, what are you afraid of? I said, this is not wimpy, fierce stuff, you know. I'm going to kill this guy, and now she's going to know it, you know. And people are going to know. And he says, Monty, what are you afraid of? It's like, okay, I'm not afraid, but if I was afraid, you know, because he puts it like that, okay, you're not afraid, but if you were afraid, what might you be afraid of? Well, you know, the guy's pretty big, and I might be afraid of him eating me out of house and home. And the guy says, okay, how can you prevent that from happening? He says, I told him. I said, well, I'll tell him he's got a place to stay. He's sleeping on the couch, but we're not going to loan him, and he's got food to eat, but we're not going to loan him money. He says, would you feel better? Would you not need to kill him if you told him that? I said, yes. And so I go out and tell him that, knowing full well my wife's going to give him money anyways, because that's her cousin. But, I will never forget, Monty, what are you afraid of? So I get to 20 years sober, and my sober wife's 40th belly button birthday. We have 30 of our closest friends over at Jasmine Restaurant over on Convoy. We got three of those great big tables, and one of my sponsees comes in late, and he's with a guy I don't like. You know, I tolerate him, but I don't like him. And I ask him, why are you late? And he says, because I'm with this guy. And that was the wrong answer. And I went off on him. And my mom used to go off on me. You would never know that love had come out of that woman's mouth. And I could do that. And I didn't know why I did that. And I did it that night. And my sponsor was there and some other senior members, and they calmed it down and made it okay. But I didn't feel good about it. And we were leaving that dinner, and there's a lady named Paula F., used to be in Lemon Grove. Now she's off somewhere else. She's 50 years sober. She's only 70 years old. But people used to tell me, you don't like her because you're so much like her. Okay? But she also went off on people. So I'm banging the steering wheel in the truck, and I'm saying, I'm a Paula. Now, I liked Paula because she said, I never wanted to drink like a lady. I wanted to drink like a pig and act like a lady. So I liked her, but, you know, we both had these, and people used to tolerate us. AA people can be so tolerant, and I was such a pain in the butt. I was a sober tight ass, you know. I thought, I'm sober now, I really can be perfect. And just like Dr. Paul, I thought you wanted to be perfect too, and I was obnoxious. So when I take a cake, I have to thank the people that love me, but mostly I have to thank the people that tolerate me, because you guys are the ones that make this work. And so what happened was, now I'm going to go back into therapy. I don't know what kind of therapy. I was friends with Bill McNulty's wife, Michelle, and we were looking for a double winner Al-Anon meeting that we had not been to before, and we were late finding it, and we didn't want to go into a meeting that we were new at late. So we end up talking in her car, and so I tell her about the birthday party, and she's telling me about this therapy that she used to do in a past life, because she had a partner that had a lot of money. And this therapy's kind of expensive. They do five-day intensives, 10 or 12 people with the therapist and with an assistant, and the room is set up in a circle, and there's one chair right in front of the therapist. They call that the hot seat. And you do that for 5 days. So it can be intensive. And I read her book. I liked her. I did an hour-long phone session with her. So I decided to go do this intensive. And it was the best week of my life, because I'm not feeling good about myself. You know, I have to do something different. And the first thing I do is I ride out to District 38, where some friends of mine are out there riding dirt bikes. I showed up in my wife's four-wheel Bronco, but because it's what brought me, I'm not going to play with it. So they loaned me a dirt bike, and I got to ride with some other people. And I went for the afternoon, and I ended up staying all weekend. And this young, new in sobriety couple had a nice fifth wheel, and they took care of me. They provided meals. They provided me a toothbrush. All I had was a sleeping bag in the back of the truck. And I really felt taken care of. It really felt good for those people to take care of me like that. I was not used to it. And now I'm going to this intensive with this therapist, And it's up in Santa Barbara. And it's in that expensive neighborhood that Oprah lives in, you know, right?
Montecito.
And so I, because I'm not a Montecito kind of guy, I get a room in Carpinteria. And if you know the area, it's like OB and PB, okay? And Carpinteria is like OB, right? So that's where I'm staying, okay? But I get up in the morning before the retreat starts, and it's the wintertime. And up there, the beaches are white sand for as far as you can see, and they're clean, you know, not a lot of seaweed and stuff. And so they had pulled this lifeguard stand back from the beach, and they didn't have a ladder to get onto it, but they pulled it far, so far back that I could jump on the wall and then jump on the lifeguard stand and go around to the front of it. And for some reason, I'm sitting on this lifeguard stand, and it occurred to me, this is my beach, okay? These are my waves, okay? These are my birds, okay? This is my breeze. These are my clouds. And another one of those little voices that I had not heard before said, and you belong to them. I'm like, and I was not good at recycling before that. You know, I had a bunch of trash behind the driver's door, right, because I'm a driver. And after that, I always found that blue container for my recycling because, you know, they belong to me and I belong to them. But that kind of, if I could offer you that kind of connection, I think we're keepers of the flame. I think that the sober life is the best life for me. That sobriety is life-affirming, that whatever power put me here wants me to have the best time for the longest time with no guarantees. So for me, sobriety is life-affirming. So I go to this intensive, and she does, she's clearing chakras with light from above. And in my system, right, with my history, the light comes through my head, down my throat, and down gets to my heart, and it goes ting, like a metal door, like a closed metal door. And I'm doing stuff that nobody at an intensive has ever done before, and I'm guided to go find a teacher. And nobody has ever been guided to leave an intensive before, and I'm carrying a teddy bear around, and I got a little tick-tock clock, you know, I'm carrying like you'd put it in with a baby stroller or a baby bassinet, and this teddy bear, I put it down, it's like forgetting to take care of myself. So of course I leave it someplace and I have to go back and find it, and it reminds me to take care of myself. And so I get guided to leave the intensive and go find a teacher. So I go out, and there's another group using the property. It's called Santa Maria. It's a retreat center, really historic place. It got burned out, and then it got flooded out when they had those big floods after they had all that burnt ground. But so I go out, and the other group that's using this facility is studying with a South American shaman, and they're doing blanket work. And I go out to look for a teacher, and there's nothing going on except these two ladies over here from that other retreat. And so I don't want to bug them, but I'm not seeing any other teachers. So I go and introduce myself, and I'm out there without my shirt on, and I'm tattooed from here to here. And I go and introduce myself and tell them I was guided to find a teacher, and I don't want to interrupt what they're doing, but when they're done, would they please come and see me on this park bench I had by a creek? And they're like, sure, and they finish up what they're doing, and they come over, and I tell them about the clearing chakra stuff, and they had this little metal bear that I still have, and they're telling me about bear energy, mother energy, nurturing energy, and they put that little bear right here on this spot, and you got a beer belly, right? You have a little spot right here, and they put that bear right there, and they said that represents mother energy, and we're going to clear chakras from the earth with love from the earth. And so the love comes up my feet and through my chakras and out through my head. Whoosh, right? And so I go back to the intensive, and nobody has ever reported that before. And I don't know how much of this I want to share about, but I'm a lucky guy is what it is. The experiences that I've had, the connection that I feel, that would not have happened without this fellowship. I'm getting down to 10 minutes, so I do want to talk a little bit more. I got introduced to some spiritual teachers. I did some guided meditations, and these two people showed up. And I mean, they weren't kind of like, they were these two guys. And I mean, I saw them so clearly. One of them looked like the skipper from Gilligan's Island. And because they don't talk, I called him Skipper. And then the other one has a goofy grin and facial hair. So I called him Gilligan. So they love me. They just show up in my morning meditation and they love me. But I don't know their names. But it makes me cry, the way they feel, the way they make me feel. And I had a friend, we were trading books, self-improvement books, Eckhart Tolle kind of books, Anthony DeMello, Byron Katie, and this guy suggests a book by Ganga G. And we'd never done anybody called G, right? And I knew about Paramahansa Yogananda and the SRF Fellowship, but because of the computers, because of Google, I don't have to wait till I get the book. I look her up. She's got a website. She seems pretty legit. There actually, at that time, there was websites that graded spiritual teachers, and for some reason, they thought she was legit. And so I click on her website, and there's a link to her teacher. And I click on that, and it's Skipper. Okay? And I'm not saying it looks kind of like him. It's him. Okay? And then there's a link to his teacher. And I click on that, and it's Gilligan. Okay? So when I say that this brand of Hindu non-duality that I practice chose me, I didn't choose it, that's the reality. That's what I've been gifted. Inner bonding opened my heart, but it did not completely heal my depression. And I was still sad when I got quiet. And I knew how non-duality handles feelings. They tell you to feel it. Actually, the term is sit with it, okay? And for as long as you need to, without repressing it or indulging it, for as long as it needs to be there, because feelings are things. They're supposed to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if I'm carrying it, it's because I'm resisting it or I'm making it worse by that resentment-type circular thinking. Right? They get wronger and wronger. I get righter and righter. So they said, sit with it. So I sit in the Lazy Boy, the house we have now, in the family room. I said, okay, I'm going to be depressed for as long as I need to be depressed without the agenda for it going away. And whoosh, it left. Okay? But so nobody ever taught me how to have a feeling. Right? So the last thing I want to talk about, if you're here and you're wondering, why can't I have a glass of wine with dinner? Okay? Most of us are old enough to have seen the movie Old Yeller. Okay? And in that movie, that dog is cool. Okay? And it befriends that lonely little boy, and it saves his brother's life. And that's what alcohol did for me. You know, my life made sense. My life was worth living. It was fun again. But in that movie, the dog is bit by a wolf, and they're afraid the wolf might be rabid. And rabies, they cannot cure. They can prevent it, but they cannot cure it. So it's similar to alcoholism, right? I was a cucumber, now I'm a pickle, and I don't ever get to be a cucumber ever again, okay? So at the end of that movie, they're afraid the dog is going to get rabies, so they put it in a shed, they lock it up. And there's a scene at the end of the movie where the dog has gone rabid and that little kid can't reach the latch on the thing to let that rabid dog out. But if I was wondering, why can't I have a glass of wine with dinner? I'm like that little boy trying to let that rabid dog out of that shed because I'm remembering the way it was instead of the way it is. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Monty. That was incredible. One more round of applause for Monty. How about a round of applause for our cooks and that spaghetti dinner tonight? How about a round of applause for everyone coming out tonight? And we can now close in our usual manner with a prayer of Monty's choice.